Hello, everyone. This is Belinda from the podcast Michael Jackson and the Truth Podcast. Today's date is July 22nd, 2023. I am recording this episode today, so you guys know what's going on. Okay, so the episode is episode 25. It would be 24, but I counted wrong. So it's episode 25, and it's called A Lot on My Mind, okay? If you notice in the show notes and in the podcast listing, the numbers have changed. So that's because of, like I just said, I counted wrong. So it's now originally episode, now it is episode 25, A Lot on My Mind. It would have been a different episode, but I'm going to get into why it was this episode in a minute. First thing I'm going to state is the best way to listen to Michael Jackson and the True Podcast is Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts, not YouTube. Anchor, which is now owned by Spotify, would not have not made the option to upload these things on YouTube, so it won't be on there. If it's on YouTube, it's not from me. It's from somebody that should not be putting my stuff on YouTube without my permission. The only person that should do that is me. So if you do see any clips on my stuff on YouTube, please email me and let me know. The website of this podcast show notes is www.michaelandthetruthpodcast.blogspot.com. All the show notes is on there. Each episode has their own post for the show notes, like this particular episode I'm doing now, that has their own show notes, so you know where all the information is coming from. The best way to contact me is MJ and the Truth Podcast at outlook.com. MJ the Truth Podcast at outlook.com. Email me with any questions you have regarding the podcast, regarding the blog, regarding my social media accounts, all that. Yes, I am on Facebook and on social media, Twitter. The Facebook page for the podcast is MJ Podcast Episodes. I think that's what it's called. All the episodes will be posted on there, so you can easily click it out, click on them and check them out for yourself. I'm on Twitter, so if you want to know what I'm on Twitter, the best thing to do is to click on the show notes website. On the side, it has a link to the Facebook page and a link to my Twitter account. Okay, so that is that with the contact information. The show notes is an update regarding the podcast. Now, what's going on? The episode that I was originally going to work on was an episode on Karen Faye and Debbie Rowe. And it's what would have been called Two Peas in a Pod. Okay, that episode is on hold until my hard drive is officially fixed, meaning my old hard drive. So what happened? Sometime late May, my hard drive on my computer broke. And I did not use my computer for 2 weeks because I had to get a whole new hard drive. I got to get a whole new stuff. And when I got all those things, I pretty much had to start over again. I do have the old hard drive and it's currently being fixed. When that is fixed, hopefully, the stuff I saved for that episode and other episodes is on there. And we can go ahead right to it and work on the episode. In the meantime, until that's fixed, there's going to be some other episode I'm going to go ahead and work on that does not need the hard drive, particularly this episode I'm recording right now, and two more episodes I'm going to record in near future. So that's regarding the update of the podcast. Things happen. It's technology. We live in a technology world, and these things are going to happen. So, but also the podcast, I did state on the last episode that I am going to end in 2024. I decided that I'm going to just keep doing the podcast. I don't know about ending it, but because it's so much going on. I don't think you can really end something that, you know, you can always go back and say, you know what, I'm going to, end it here or put it there. It's a lot. It's a lot. It's always something. So I'm just going to just keep doing the podcast until I run out of ideas. So that's pretty much it. I'm not going to really end it next year. I'm just going to do what I can. And so I have a lot of ideas for the podcast anyway. So, the things that changed since the last episode is that two people passed on, maybe a few more, a lot more, but a few notable ones in the fan community, passed on. Tina Turner and Scott Ross. So, of course, the legendary great Tina Turner passed away in May. So, she was friends with Michael, with Janet, and she's a legend. You know, we all love Tina Turner. Tina Turner was one of the first celebrities I ever loved as a child. Of course, Michael and others. So, her death shocked me. I found out on YouTube. I found out about it on YouTube, and I was like, oh, wow, this is crazy. But anyway, I wanted to read something that Michael's photographer, Harrison Funk, said about Michael watching the movie What's Love Got to Do With It with Tina Turner. Just a little bit of how Michael felt about her. And because there's not a lot of information about how Michael felt about Tina Turner that's out there. But I wanted to read this to just give people an understanding of what he thought about her. So I'm going to read to you. Yet, for all the fun they had together, Funk's most cherished memory is Jackson is a dark one. He remembers sitting with the singer in the home theater of his Neverland Ranch while watching a movie, What's Love Got to Do With It, the 1993 biopic of the abusive relationship between Ike and Tina Turner. Well, let me stop there. It's about her life, but most of it is about that abusive relationship, and it's based on a book that she wrote. So not all of it is about Mike Turner beating up Tina Turner. I mean, when Jackson began to cry. The scene where Ike beats on Tina was playing, and Michael started to tear up. I asked him if he wanted me to stop the film, but he signaled to keep it rolling. He squeezed my hand tightly. I really felt his humanity in that moment. After the film ended, we walked to the theater, and Michael asked me to go do bumper cars with him. Funk laughs. We played pretty nasty and really went for one another. He was like a big kid. So, we all know that scene in the movie where Ike Turner really, really, really hurt Tina in that movie. It's an emotional movie. We know that it's an emotional roller coaster, but it shows Michael's, you know, compassion for others and what they go through. And I wanted to really play that. But, you know, Tina was a wonderful woman. May she rest in peace. There are people out there who were already trying to imply she was, her situation was this or that. And, you know, people who do that have wickedness in their heart. And I'm not going to stand for that. She's an icon who changed the world with her music and her impact, and really encourage women to go and, you know, be their authentic selves. And that's her true legacy. People have a problem with what she said. That's their problem. And what she did, that's her problem. But I'm not in the business of questioning what's true, what's false about someone who was legitimately abused in a relationship. I think that's insensitive. I think that's evil. And I think that's wrong. Alright? So, may she rest in peace. And thank you, Tina, for everything. The next person who passed away, who was close to Michael, was Scott Ross, which shocked me. I was doing something on Facebook, looking at something. I saw the news. I said, what? I couldn't believe what happened. I found out last month, June. He died in May. So, we don't know what took his life, but this shocked me. I did not see this coming at all. He did a lot for Michael, especially after that ridiculous Leave Neverland Trash came out. And, you know, yes, he did support the defense for the Kyron Murray murder case, but he doesn't have to agree with everything that happened in Michael's life. But doesn't have to do that. No one has to, right? We don't have to agree on things, but I know that Scott Ross is a genuine person, and when he saw the fraudulent liars lying, just straight up lying on Michael, and just them, not just Michael, Scott Ross, you know, the lawyers that worked in that trial, you know, he had to say something. Rightfully so. He had to say something. And that, to me, that's who you are. You know, when you see wrongdoing and you don't do anything about it, you don't sit there and go, whoa, this is not cool. That's wrongdoing. And that's just sitting there letting it happen. That's wrong to me. When you see something isn't right, who's stopping you from saying, hey, let me tell you what the real story is? Nobody. Scott Ross, you know, people were reaching out to him and say, hey, can you come forward and talk about it? He did. He didn't have to, but he did. And that right there is who he really was to me. He told it all and didn't care, you know. And I appreciate that from him. And that's really all that matters. He kept going, too. I don't know what took his life. None of us do. Maybe his family do not want to reveal that. And I appreciate that. Let me tell you who Scott Ross was. He was a private investigator who was considered a crucial member of the hashtag Michael Jackson defense team in the 2005 trial. So he did interviews with MJ Kaz, of course, Nicole's View. He did interviews with all kinds of people. With all kinds of people. So let me read you an article. This is the only article that talked about him, because of course he's not going to tell you the negative tea that mainstream trash media wants you to tell you. There's options now. They're going to do the right thing and report to you what happened. So the article is from the website yc.news. That's what it's called. It's called Your Content, and it's titled Scott Ross, the Investigator Hollywood Trusted Remembered. Okay. All right, let me read you a little bit of what the article stated. The world of Hollywood has suffered a great loss with the passing of Scott Ross, the go-to private investigator of the industry's elite. Ross died May 2nd at the age of 66. Ross was an accomplished private investigator who played key roles in host of notable cases involving celebrities such as Robert Blake, Michael Jackson, Chris Brown, Sylvester Stallone, Danny Matheson, and Bill Cosby. The celebrity investigator is well known in his own right. Whenever high-profile figures sought an investigator, their choice was often Ross, who was well-regarded and respected within the entertainment industry. His dynamic personality and the esteemed company he kept only amplified his reputation, which is so important, because even though, he said things we disagree with regarding this Carmen Murray thing, he still had credibility, he still had respect, which is important. The last private investigator who worked with Michael in these dumbass trials, Anthony Palatico, actually went to jail for he did some illegal stuff. Now, has he had some information that was important? Yes, but unfortunately, he did some slimy stuff. So, you know, you need to be around someone that doesn't have that thing, because it makes you look bad. So, you don't see that with Scott Ross. Scott Ross was pretty much clean, you know what I'm saying? Tom Mezzo, remember Scott Ross? Okay, Tom Mezzo has something to say about that. Famed Los Angeles attorney Tom Mezzo expressed his admiration and respect for the late Scott Ross, Hollywood's leading private investigator. He recounts meeting Ross during his defense of actor Robert Blake, who was charged with murder of his wife. I met Scott Ross when I was defending actor Robert Blake, who was accused of murdering his wife, Mezzo told Your Contact. Scott Ross had been the prior lawyer investigator. When I entered the case, I had a lot of meetings with Scott about what work he had done, and I was extremely impressed. He was very detailed, meticulous, organized, and well-connected. It became a routine for Mezzo to consult Ross due to his noteworthy skills, which surpassed those of his contemporaries. He had a lot of common sense. I had my own set of investigators, and I kept comparing them to Scott Ross, and he was way superior. I would often call Scott and run things by him, and he was far superior than others. When Mezzo was selected as counsel for Michael Jackson during the infamous child molestation case, he chose Ross as his investigator, attributing to his decision to Ross' exceptional expertise and the confidence he had in his capabilities. When I got into the Michael Jackson case, I wanted Scott Ross, Mezzo continued. When I became Mr. Jackson's counsel, I had to pick a very good investigator, and Scott Ross was my choice. He was very dedicated to what he did. Very careful. He had a lot of contacts in government and law enforcement. He was just a great investigator. Harlan Braun remembers Scott Ross. Okay. Harlan Braun was another distinguished attorney based in Los Angeles. Praised Ross's unwavering dedication to each case and client, emphasizing that Ross never let financial constraints interfere with his exhaustive investigations. Braun was also recalled their personal relationship fondly, noting Ross' attendance at his daughter's wedding in South Carolina and the many ways he assisted Braun's family. Ross was an investigator who worked on many cases over my career, Braun told Your Contact. Scott was very devoted to each client and never cut a corner to allow financial concerns to short-circuit an investigation. Scott took our relationship as personal as well professional. He came to my daughter's wedding in South Carolina and assisted my family in many different ways. Braun's impressive legal career includes high-profile cases defending notable individuals. His clients have ranged from film director Ron Pernowski and Eric Melendez to one of his infamous Melendez brothers to actor Robert Blake. Braun also represented Dr. Richard Boggs, a high-profile murder case, former U.S. Congressman Gary Conda during a significant political scandal, and musician Sean Puffy Combs in a case related to gun possession and bribery. Braun further underlined Ross's unique qualifications as an investigator, one of which was his lack of a former career as a peace officer. This allowed Ross to approach each case mutually, thereby gaining the trust of witnesses who might otherwise be distrustful of ex-cops. One of Scott's clear qualifications is that he was never a police officer. He did not have a pro-police bias as he investigated each case. He started from a neutral position, which is difficult for a former police officer to maintain if he has served 20 to 30 years as a cop, Braun continued. Scott never had to rely on a badge to get cooperation, so he was able to get many witnesses who were suspicious of former cops to talk. Braun likened having Ross as an investigator to having co-counsel, highlighting Ross' ability to analyze cases from both an investigative and legal perspective. Braun expressed that he would deeply miss Ross' presence. Having Scott as an investigator was like having a co-counsel, Braun told Your Contact. He analyzed each case from both an investigation perspective as well as a legal perspective. I would definitely miss Scott. In poignant reminisce, Braun recounted a personal incident involving his mentally ill mother. Found near death in a heavy, cluttered home, Braun and Ross spent nearly a week cleaning the house and an act of kindness. Braun would never forget, further underlining his deep sense of loss of Ross's passing. I have a mother with severe mental illness. We had to stop communicating with her to protect our children. The police found her almost dead in her house. Her home was a mess and it was hard to explain. Let's say it was filled with maggots, which took Scott and I almost a week to clean up. That is a favor I will never forget, Scott's help. Again, I will miss Scott Ross. Karen Morrison remembers Scott Ross' pro bono work. Karen G. Morrison, the founder and president of Fighting for Freedom, has praised the late Scott Ross as an invaluable mentor and team member to their nonprofit organization. Ross' expertise and guidance significantly enhanced the group's ability to effectively handle cases and consider evidence from a more factual viewpoint rather than merely emotional, Morrison stated. Scott Ross was more than just a private investigator to us at Fighting for Freedom. He was a mentor, a guide, and a valued team member. He did not just help us with cases. He taught us how to look at them differently, to focus on hard facts instead of just emotions, Morrison said. Scott understood the rules of the game, and he helped us navigate between constitutional and due process rights, giving us an edge we wouldn't have had otherwise. According to Morrison, Ross' dedication contributed to their organization on a pro bono basis, which was a significant turning point, enabling them to draw on additional pro bono resources and take on complex cases that were previously beyond their capability. His generous spirit shone through when he began helping our nonprofit pro bono. His expertise was a game changer, bringing in other pro bono attorneys and helping us take cases we previously couldn't do to lack of experience, Morrison told Your Contact. Scott's work was transformative, shifting our perspectives and helping us better advocate for individuals seeking clemency. He helped us understand complex matters like DNA evidence, lifespan, felony murder rule, and witness misidentification. His wisdom wasn't just shared, it was instrumental in our successes. She remembered Ross as an extraordinary individual whose dedication was apparent in every case he worked on. His influence continues to inspire their work, and Morrison expressed deep gratitude for his contributions to justice and their organization. Scott was an extraordinary man. His dedication was felt in every case he touched. His influence remained a driving force in our organization, Morrison continued. We are grateful for his time, his expertise, and most importantly, his heartfelt commitment to justice. He was an asset. Scott Ross' career and cell tower breakthrough. Scott Ross, revered as one of California's leading private investigators, embarked his career in 1979 as an intern, obtained his license in the state of California in May 1983, and subsequently established Scott Ross private investigations in April 1986. Over the years, Scott tackled an array of criminal cases ranging from serious felonies and violent crimes to capital death penalty and murder cases, as well as less severe charges like DUI. His clientele spanned attorneys from across the country. In 2008, his career evolved to incorporate the development of cellular site technology necessitating mastery of this area where required. During a murder case in Palo Alto, California, Scott Ross and the involved attorneys realized the need for the cellular site expert. With no ready available resources, Scott took the initiative to learn about cell towers and cell sites. As he dove deeper into the subject, he discovered the crucial role of this information could play on various cases and potential for both use and misuse. With federal directives passed in 2010, mandating GPS capability in all cell phones, the significance of cellular information escalated, making it more important than ever. After several years of study and practice, Ross was recognized as an expert in cellular analysis by the State of California Superior Court. He conducted cellular analysis in 12 different states, testifying in both California and Missouri. Notably, his expertise also extended to assisting law enforcement in interpreting cell site data. Ross is a native of San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles, received his education at Los Angeles Valley College in Loyola Marymount University. His career kick started in 1979 under the mentorship of retired U.S. Marshal Angelo Chick Canzoneri. Upon receiving his license in 1983, Ross went on to form a partnership with Ted Gunson, a retired FBI special agent in charge, in June 1986. This collaboration led to his involvement in high-profile cases such as the McMartin preschool child molestation case and the reinvestigation of Robert Kennedy's assassination, conducted for Gerardo Rivera's 25th anniversary special commemoration of Senator Kennedy's death. So that is it. And wow, he had a really accomplished life. And it's good to, you know, it's important for people to know. There's a part where someone said about him that he wanted the, sorry y'all, I just read an article. He wanted the people to look at the work in not an emotional state, but in a factual state. And that's important. That's important to have that, you know what I mean? Because if you don't look at things with the facts, you look at them with your emotion, then you really can't do what you can do with that, you know what I mean? So may he rest in peace. I thank him for everything. He didn't have to do what he did, but he did. And he really made a difference out there. And we will never forget him. So you have a chance, take the time to, you know, check out his interviews he did with the MJ cast. He did with Nicole's View. You can even go on YouTube and type it in and it'll pop up. So take the time to listen to it. And another person, I think his name is Gavin. I forget his last name, but he's a lawyer. He did an interview with him too. So just check it out when you get a chance. The next topic is Toure is the last to talk. Now, who is Toure? Toure is a quote-unquote journalist who says some really silly things about Michael last month. I decided I'm going to talk about it. So, he did an interview with the Griot. The Griot is not black-owned, okay? But they aim at the black community, okay? It's about MJ, and he even gave Diane Diamond, or what we call her in the fan community, Diane Demon, a shout-out for convincing him that Michael was this so-called pedophile. Toure wanted people to show him evidence Michael was not a pedophile, but instead of looking at the evidence, he blocked anyone that wanted to show him evidence. So what happened was, he did this interview, and he running his stinky mouth, talking about Michael, I don't know why. And he had the nerve to go say, well, now I believe that Michael probably did those things. Toure, I want to make something clear. Toure always believed Michael did those things. He's just saying that to get clout because he can't get a job. So he wants to be on the good graces of people who might get him a job. Don't fall for it. He's not a Michael Jackson supporter, or, you know, he's more of a hater than a supporter. He's a Prince fan, and I'm not knocking on anyone who's a Prince fan. I'm a Prince fan myself, but a lot of people who are Prince fans are also bitter. They're very bitter when it comes to Michael's success and all that. So they huff and puff and bring up stuff about Michael that was already proven to be false. This fool is one of them. And let me make it clear, Prince could care less about Torre, okay? Torre wrote books on Prince that his fans don't even care to buy or look at. And Torre does a podcast on Prince. I don't listen to it because I don't care what Torre thinks about anybody. But a fan stated that he asked for proof he had ever spoken about MJ scandals in the 90s and 2000s, so I got blocked for providing it. So in other words, basically, he wanted proof that he ever talked about the scandals Michael went through in the past. And she showed the proof, the fan showed the proof to him, and he blocked her. Yeah, he has talked about the scandals in the past. I remember one where he was on Daylight NBC in 2003, and he was running his mouth talking about making fun of Michael taking Manny Lewis to the 1984 Grammys. And I'm like, okay, what did you try to get at? So he was always talking about Michael in that disrespectful way. And when you show, and when she showed, or that individual showed Torre the evidence, he blocked. He blocked him. Of course Torre would block you when you show the proof, because he doesn't want to accept the fact that he was wrong. So why is he even talking about Michael? Because maybe he's trying to let people know, wait a minute, that he is a predator his damn self. So he wants to use Michael as a smokescreen. Music journalist Torre accused of sexual harassment. So, sometime in 2019, this fool was accused of sexually harassing women at the workplace. And instead of, you know, keeping his mouth shut about Michael Jackson and other people, he must have forgotten that his stinky ass is a predator and should not be around women or people, period. Did you know that Torre apologized? He apologized for sexually harassing women. So he has admitted to be a predator. Does anyone want to go to work and have their... Now, this clip, information I'm reading, comes from a Instagram post someone made of Torre's stinky, disgusting ways. And this was published on a Jasmine Brand blog, or, yeah, well, blog, but probably her Instagram post. Jasmine Brand is a celebrity gossip website, social media account. But let me read to you what the person said. Does anyone want to go to work and have their coworker ask about their asshole? Sorry, I don't mean to curse. I didn't even see that coming. If you have shaved or waxed your... If you like us and suggest they try with him, have a man to... Oh, wow. I'm sorry. I can't even read any of this anymore. Anyone tell you you must have had from... Because... looks good, that your legs are sexy and tease you by pretending to grab them while you're doing your job. If you like during touch-ups when you mumble under your breath how sexy I am. He was not liked. He was tolerated for everyone to get paid, period. So, clearly, this sick human being is running around, you know, saying ridiculous things about Michael when he's a predator. I mean, I can't even read some of this stuff because I'm disgusted. And you wonder, why do these hypocrites do what they do when it comes to Michael? Well, they do what they do when it comes to Michael because Michael is a smokescreen. They know everybody knows these lies about him, so instead of, you know, talking about themselves being predators, let's use Michael, the age-old person to use, so nobody knows that they're creeps. But the internet is not going to forget that, right? And that's going to know that you are a predator. All we got to do is Google it. And we Google it and find out you are the, that Torre is a disgusting human being. I had to stop reading. I was disgusted. and he got fired. He's not gonna, he doesn't have a job. So how can you get a, how can you make money? You still gotta, you know, trash your people. Remind people Michael's his so-called child molester, or remind people that Bill Cosby is his so-called child molester. Let's not remind the people you're a creep. And, you know, they have to tolerate your crap so you can, so they can have a job. Nobody should ever go through that. So, he apologized. That means he admit that he, what he said was wrong and that he lost his job. So, whenever you see Torre, just laugh at this fool and keep him moving. He's a joke. He's a nobody. And he's a predator. And that's his record right there. That's who he is. Okay? He can run his mouth, talk mess about Michael for the rest of his life. He's trash. Okay? Next up is History 28. Thank goodness he made, he did the album. So, the anniversary of History was 28 years ago. And the sound engineer that was working with Michael on the album, Brad Sundberg, tells a lengthy story about the album. So I'm going to read to you what he said. I'm going to read to you what he said. And it's lengthy, so get ready. But I say this because I want to make a point of how important this album is. Of course, we know the song from the album, They Don't Care About Us, reached 1 billion views on YouTube. So, you know, we know that they tried to ban that song on the radio, on MTV. But look at it now. It's 1 billion views on YouTube. So let's read it. Happy 28th birthday History. 29 years and 5 months ago, we started a Michael Jackson project in New York, which would eventually be called the History Album, released 28 years ago today. That would have been June 16th at the time we made this post. Over the course of those 17-ish months, we helped Michael create an album like none he ever done before, and it was amazing. There have been plenty of reviews and opinions about the content of the project, but I prefer to share insights about Michael the person and what it was like working on this and many other projects. So by 1994, I had known Michael for nearly 10 years. After meeting and working with him on the Captain EO project at Westlake Studios, EO seemed so far away from the gritty streets of Manhattan where we worked on History. During those EO sessions, he was so focused yet fun-loving, you couldn't help but be drawn to him. Music industry people understand that professional space you should give an artist, meaning they didn't book a world-class studio looking to make new friends, but friendships were naturally formed. I genuinely loved being around Michael, and it was amazing that he knew my name, laughed at my jokes, and generally interested in me. Over the next several years, I stayed with Michael working on the Bad album, Dangerous, many short films and special projects, and of course the Endless Music Systems and his amazing Neverland Ranch. I don't talk about this very much, but after the Dangerous album, I was easing out of the studio life and focusing full-time on system design and installation. It's a slightly complicated story, but in my mind, Dangerous would be the last album I worked on. Dead in early 1994, we had a nasty earthquake in LA, a deadly tragic quake. A few days later, my phone rang and it was Bruce Sudeikin, my mentor and friend. Sudeikin, so he goes on to say, Sudeikin, Brad, we need you to go to New York and start a new Michael project. Meaning Brad. Bruce, no, I can't drop everything and move to New York for a year. Bruce, it won't be a year. I want you there and Michael wants you there. Brad, Michael wants me there? Bruce, yes, he wants you on this project and so do I. Me, after a few moments of silence, or Brad, when do I leave? And that's how it started, and it lasted 5 months longer than my initial estimate. A week or two later, I was stomping through the snow of Manhattan to get set up at both Hit Factory and Sony Music Studios. My buddy Brad Brockster was the next to arrive at. And the first song he played me was the early version of Stranger in Moscow. And I knew I had made the right decision. I wanted to be part of a project that could produce that level of music. I remember calling Bruce and holding the phone on the speaker so he could hear it after telling him, you're going to love this song. We all did. Soon, Michael and his security team arrived. And all felt right again. The little studio family with a few new faces was back together just in a new venue. Michael was filled with energy and ideas. He was writing songs, laughing, running around the studio, running around from studio to studio. It was entirely his show. The project got bigger and bigger. Soon we had several studios booked in New York, LA, Minneapolis, Atlanta, and Virginia Beach. We were shipping tapes, flying in musicians and choirs, hiring orchestras, and enjoying New York. The hours were very long, but from time to time we could sneak out and enjoy a hockey game or a Stones concert or a subway ride out to Coney Island. Michael allowed me to bring my family out for cell visits, and his office took really good care of us. The project almost took on a life of his own, with song after song in full production. The music was a bit of a mirror of his emotions. Some songs showed anger and frustration, while others reflected innocence, fear, love, triumph, reflection, and humor. It was remarkable, rewarding, and exhausting to help bring these songs to the first potential. We recorded sound effects, Little Susie, street sounds, they don't care about us, too bad, giving the record almost a theatrical vibe. And Michael had been through a lot since our EO days a decade before, but you almost wouldn't know it. He was funny, confident, self-driven. He had more ideas than we could keep up with, and the project got bigger and bigger. We always knew it was going to be the best of record with a handful of new songs, but that in itself caused a lot of limitations. A CD would only hold 77 minutes of music, so which classic songs should we leave off, and how many new songs will be allowed? Sorry. One day, Michael, Brad, Buxter, and I were in the lounge talking about this dilemma, and I suggested a double album. It was just too much incredible material, old and new, to be limited to maybe 38 minutes for each. You got so much great music here, you really need to start thinking about doing a double album, I said. The seed was planted. By then, Lisa Marie was popping into the studio on a regular basis, and there was nothing sweeter than seeing the two of them walk quietly down the hallway holding hands. It wasn't a show. They were truly in love. Musicians and producers like Steve Perraco and David Foster from LA were recruited to help this record finish. It was significantly over budget and over time, but Michael had a vision, and our job was to create this mammoth work the way he heard it in his head. Each song had to be unique and perfect, with every attempt to find, record, and utilize sounds that the world has never heard before. I estimate at one point we had 13 studios full of production in various cities, and Michael really was the maestro at the center of it all. We returned to LA for much of the mixing, and then back to New York for the final touches of quality control, then back to LA for tour prep. Then it was over. I have met people who line up for hours to purchase History when it was released 28 years ago. For many, particularly in Europe, it would be their first Michael concert. The statues, the mega tour, the promotion. Depending on which source you choose to believe, the History album has globally sold more than 25 million copies, making it one of the highest selling albums of all time. It also said to be the highest selling double album of all time, although Pink Floyd also claims this spot with The Wall. Either way, it was a massive seller. But for me, History took place primarily at 421 West 54th Street in New York. Over the course of those 17 months, it snowed, it rained, it was hot, and it was cold. And there was so much laughter, so much music, so much love. The team was quite small, but we welcomed gifted people from all over the world to share their voices, musicianship, and engineering skills. It was a unique and sometimes ragtag a family as you could ever imagine. And I have every reason to believe that Michael loved every bit of it. Thank you, Applehead, for letting me be part of this remarkable album and help you bring it to life. I love you and I miss you, Brad. That was nice. Wasn't that nice? Nice little memory of that album. That did a lot. That was posted on his Facebook page. So, if you want, you can check it out. I post a link on the show notes so you can check it out. And someone brought up a very interesting point. You know, a lot of people say Michael didn't play instruments. Whenever you hear that, just ignore it. It's not true. Michael did play instruments. And he played instruments in his album, especially the History album, okay? Could Michael play any musical instruments? Yes, Jesse used to play guitar, piano, drums, synthesizer, and percussion instruments on History, his ninth studio album. But he could not play them masterfully. And we don't expect him to. That wasn't in that part. I'm adding that part. There were a few instruments that Michael Jackson could play at ease without any professional training. His father trained him. The Jacksons became one of the best performers of his time under his guidance. So that was the information there. Yes, he played instruments, but why didn't I expect him to play instruments thoroughly? No. Why would I? All right. So that was it with the History. album anniversary. And around that time, it was June 13th. We all know that's 18 years since the anniversary of his Vindication, and also June 25th. So let's start with June 13th. Let me get that information. I don't see it. So you can see that. 18 years since Mike was Vindicated. So, I mean, of course, that was talked about. And that's a big anniversary in the fan community. The day Michael was vindicated from these ridiculous cases that he had to deal with. And someone said on Twitter, they were looking at something, and they said they showed Vitti Gutierrez telling her that he needs MJ because if MJ is guilty, that means people will have to accept it as normal and we shouldn't be angry. Now, what am I talking about? Okay, what is this individual talking about? Well, they were watching some nonsense of, I want to say like nonsense. They were watching some information of nonsense, meaning hard copy and all them, talking about how they were going to frame Michael. The allegations against Michael were created by a guy named Vitti Gutierrez. Vitti Gutierrez was trying to use Michael's fame to normalize pedophilia. That's where this nonsense is coming from. So if Michael is found guilty of these things, his goal, Gutierrez's goal, is to make it normal. So people can say, oh, it's acceptable. We can make it normal by using this guy's fame. And that's where this nonsense is coming from. So every time we try to fight against this stupidity, we have to remember that some twisted human being created this on him to make pedophilia normal. And that's what we're dealing with here, okay? And even though, you know, people don't want to hear those things, that's what happened, okay? So when you think about June 13th, remember that, where this nonsense came from. Twisted minds of sick human beings. And also uses these allegations he's been through as a projection to their own sickness, like what this clown Torre did. That's how they roll. And that's, they ignore Michael's empathy towards people who are abused victims. Like when you saw with what I read regarding Tina Turner and what she's been through. And if you're also curious about Tina Turner's life, I posted an article from the New York Times about her life. So you can click on it on the show notes and read it for yourself. But it just tells you, you know, what we're dealing with. And also, June 25th is the 14th anniversary of Michael's passing. Of course, he trended on social media 14 years without Michael Jackson and hashtag the King of Pop. Obviously, people still care years later about the great MJ. And an article from MJVibe.com talks about that. The world remembers Michael Jackson 14 years after his passing. The love the King of Pop for the King of Pop never felt stronger. Fans around the world posted their tributes on social media platforms, parade to key locations around the world, such as his resting place at Forest Lawn, home in Neverland Ranch, Haverhurst family home, and other key locations where the King of Pop filmed, lived, or visited. Other parts of the world, such as the different statues of the iconic singer and memorial places that fans have placed since 2009, have seen the visits of hundreds of fans coming together to remember Michael. Okay, and so that is what they did. And of course, family have their tributes and all that. And it was, as usual, was really nice. So, this is what they do, what fans do for Michael and his legacy after Michael passes away, charity work, planting plants, all that. And we all have our stories of how we felt when we found out Michael passed on. I talked about that on one of my previous episodes. And people went back to his hometown to honor him. So, the Chicago Tribune did an article talking about that. And then a fan did a... Her name is Hannah. She did a blog post talking about the 14 years since Michael passed on. Get checked out that blog post. And there's a video of someone who traveled to other parts of, you know, like, travel the house that he was at before he passed on, and up to where he was at, where he's buried at, and there's a video talking about that as well. And it doesn't get easier. Every year it gets hard, you know. People say it gets you easier as time going on, goes on. Not with me. I don't know about some of you, but with me, no. It doesn't get easier. And as we celebrate Michael, we watch him get loved during that time. Your favorite, those idiots of the mainstream media, their favorite pastime is always hitting on a Michael. And the haters couldn't stand the love. You know they couldn't stand it. So I don't know. We can't have this. We got to remind people he's this or he's that. And you know what happened. After we celebrate MJ, the haters continue with the nonsense. And that's what he did. We got the two false accusers supposed trial. And Michael's killer goes back to work. After we celebrated Michael, his false accusers decided to let the world know that they want to go to trial for their failed cases. And the mainstream media made sure to report it. So let's read the laughable nonsense. Now, this came from TMZ. We will find out July 26th. So that's next week, next Wednesday, I believe. If there will be a trial. I'm not worried about a trial. I say bring it on. Because the media wants you to think we should be worried about this trial. We're not worried. The media intentionally did not report the real story about nothing. So about, well, not nothing, about this ridiculousness. So they want to play a game with manipulating the public to thinking that we need to be worried about some trial. I'm not worried about this trial. I'm not worried. I know there are people out there saying, well, the jury might be suspect. I hear you. I actually agree with you on that. But I don't think a common sense person, however they feel, because they can feel how they want to feel, it's not going to change facts, are going to take these people seriously, especially this doofus, these two doofuses. Their story, they had all the press to promote their ridiculous story, and it still did nothing. Their cases were dismissed. I talked about that in previous episodes. Their cases were dismissed, and they're trying again. In a ridiculous joy statement, these two fools tell us a sexual abuser's passing does not deprive his victims of their day in court, and in turn, justice and healing. Michael Jackson is not sued personally in this case, of his company is, and his company will have every opportunity to defend itself in the trial. They continue, we are pleased that the Court of Appeal has taken the time and considered all the facts and the applicable law in these cases. We look forward to oral arguments next month and eventual decision of Court of Appeal. Okay, let's look at this ridiculous statement. First of all, these two fools never wanted this to go to trial. Wade Robson wanted to do this under the table to get the estate to pay. It didn't happen. Wade Robson is a sexual abuser, not Michael Jackson. Michael Jackson never sexually abused his animal or the other animal. Wade Robson has victims out there that cannot get charges filed. That's why he's in Hawaii, because he comes to the States, they easily can charge him with a crime. And he's in Hawaii right now to escape, in my opinion, to escape a lot of stuff, including a sexual case involving a minor. And her family friend tried to tell people on Twitter, but they got his account suspended. So don't fall for this nonsense. It's a laughable statement. We are not going to support an abuser. We are supporting an innocent man that's been proven. There was no facts in their case because that's why it was dismissed. They couldn't prove anything they're saying. So they want to play around. Their stupid, avid, analyst chasing lawyers want to play games and say, we're going to get our story told. Your story was told already. And it flopped each time. So stop playing games. You know, they act like we're afraid of some case. We're not afraid of this case, Doug. You know, Michael was not sued personally. Yeah, he can't be sued personally. You wouldn't sue him when he was living today because you wouldn't have a case to sue him in. If he was, you can only do it to him when he's deceased. But his companies are not going to pay if they were not under your company. You have to prove that they allowed the abuse to happen. If your mom was there all the time, how is that possible? If your mom was in your, it was in, was there in your every move, how is that possible? If he barely hung out with you, how is it possible? You had to prove that, Wade and James. I mean, James never worked under Michael's thing, so what is he talking about? It didn't exist when James was there. I mean, now, if this goes to trial, what does it look like? You're trying a dead person, which is laughable. You should not be trying people who are gone. They're deceased, they're deceased. Move on. You had time to get this guy. They didn't do it. You know, what is these two cases really about? Since a dead natural person cannot be sued, Wade Robson had to make a case against MJ's company, MJ Productions, and MJ Ventures to get monetary compensation he desired. Yeah, that's what they're doing it for. Money. Okay? Much less he owns parents' homes, of course. The tour he claims abuse started was not organized by the MJ companies, but by Pepsi. One of these men, James Safechuck, had nothing whatsoever to do with these companies. He was never employed by them. Neverland, where he claims abuse happened, was never owned by the companies. Wade was employed by the companies at one point after they begged Michael to help them with green cards for their immigration, but his alleged abuse didn't arise out of that company relationship. And that's the problem with their ridiculous cases. There's no evidence. So all they have is smoke and mirrors. They don't have anything. The desperate strategy from Wade and James have been portrayed, The desperate strategy from Wade and James has been to portray Norma. Norma is Michael, was Michael's secretary, assistant, and other entities at Neverland as master puppeteers in the most extensive child sexual abuse procurement op imaginable that only Wade and James were ever part of. But it's disproved even from most of Wade's own witnesses. So Norma, who's an elderly woman, they want you to think she created this thing to put kids around Michael, which is ridiculous. Okay? With those remarks from Joy, it all came from Michael. She unwittingly dismantled their own litigation strategy of blaming MJ staffers over alleged child sexual abuse programming and cover-up. These two false accusers still include the known lie about Norma purely to help sell their case against companies. It's very obvious that Wade uses CM's version. Who's CM? I have no idea who CM is. Version of this story and not his mother's, because it involves Norma, and that's the element he needs to blame the companies. But his mother told him in an email this was a lie. Still, Wade used this false story. Okay, Norma. Okay. When MJ Innocent discussed the lies of Wade, it's not did he lie in 2005. It's about the undisputed facts proving he lied in 2013 declaration regarding estate concealment, a tell-all book, lies about emails, suppression of discovery, inclusion of claims, even his mom said were untrue. Okay, so this situation, if it does go to trial, this is dangerous, especially for black people. And why I say it like that is because we know black celebrities are targets. All celebrities are targets, but mostly black people are targets. And we see that with Michael Jackson, of course, Bill Cosby, etc. They are going to find a way to get the money back. They don't want Michael to have a legacy. And they don't want Michael to rest in peace. As he should. He should rest in peace because it's deceased. And move on. These two fools don't want that to happen. They want something from this guy. Everybody else benefiting, but not them. And so, if this goes through, I'm worried for the future. If something happens to you and you passed on, some clown that you don't care about or you had a falling out with or you don't know can say anything and say, look, this person did this, I can prove it, and they're going to allow it to happen because it happened before. And that is what I mean. This is going to become a thing. Remember, the person who allowed, made sure that Emmett Till did not get his justice. Carol Bryant got to live her life and not get charged with what she did to him. And she passed away. Nobody is going to get her for that because she's deceased. But we can go get a guy who already cleared his name, already is handled, this is handled and done with. We're going to go and try to get something out of this because two fools said so. Two fools who can't prove their case said so. They saw what happened June 25th and got in their feelings. Because we are not going to stop celebrating a dude that did nothing to these bums. And that's really what the anger is. I'm going to tell you why I think, the real reason why I think one of the false accusers will never, ever have a career again in that, in any industry, particularly that particular industry. So that's what I think. I think it will change the legal system for the worse. And that's what I think. Now, I posted two articles that talk about this ridiculous case and a video done by a Andy Sengmore, but he has a YouTube channel called, it is called Popcorn Planet, Popcorned Planet, and he breaks down, he's one of the few people that actually, on YouTube that actually, smell right through this clown and his these clowns in a ridiculous case, and he breaks down all this nonsense. And I did some thinking on the root to why these false accusers continue to do this. What's going on? Yes, they're failures, but what is also their issue? And I think they have an obsession with Michael that is sexual. And I'm not trying to imply that Michael initiated sexual thing here, because Michael is not gay, nor he's a pedophile. I think these two men have an issue here that is borderline sexual. So let me read to you what some people said, and I'll tell you what I think. Well, I told you what I think, but I'm going to tell you what they said. Thank you. I've always said that these two 40-plus-year-old men were speaking as adults who lusted after Michael. And I'm going to stop right there. That's what I mean. I think they have a lust for him. Because why are you so fixated on this thing when you know nothing happened? We saw your movie. Some people watched your movie. Some people saw it. They broke it down. There's no evidence of abuse. You just say your stuff and make it a stick, and it doesn't just stick. You have a court case. It doesn't come out in your favor. You can't seem to, like, accept it and move on. You got to keep going. What do you try to get out of here? They wanted those things to happen, and it did not. And also remember, these men were spewing a script written by a pedophile / NAMBLA member, Vitia Gutierrez. Yeah, that's what it is. They want this to happen. Okay? And it didn't happen. And then one fan said, fan is a man's fan and poster. His mother said he was jealous and possessive of Michael. He was obsessed like so many others are about Michael. There's a pattern with his accusers that they all got mad when they moved on or distanced himself. So they got revenge and accused him. Of course. I mean, that's what these two knuckleheads did. Look how one of them hung on to Michael any way he could. Date the niece. Befriend the family, even said they will, after Michael died, we want to go and adopt his children. Like, why? Even filming some nonsense at Neverland by begging the nanny of one of his children or his children to ask Michael to get him to film his stupid video at Neverland. When Neverland wasn't even living there anymore at that time. Okay? So this is a guy who don't know when to move on. False accuser, Wei Ropes' his whole life has been Michael Jackson. The guy's obsessed, so obsessed he made himself a fake victim just to keep talking about Michael when he realized his career wasn't going anywhere after Michael died. One of the worst opportunistic liars out there. Yeah, he is definitely obsessed with Michael. On top of that, his career is over. And he needs to talk about Michael to keep remember, he wanted to be relevant and relatable. He wants to keep talking about Michael. So he calls, he creates him, he pretends to be a false accuser so he can continue to talk about this guy. Now, the depths that somebody went to destroy their career is mind-boggling. It's almost like you gotta shake your head at this shit. So I'm gonna read to you a post that a gentleman, now his name is Darian Henson. Darian Henson is a choreographer, also an actor. He was the original choreographer for Britney Spears and NSYNC in during their heyday. Darian Henson started off, he also worked with Michael too. He has a documentary out that talks about his time in the entertainment business that you can watch it on a play on a network called All Black. I think it's called All Black. He does a documentary and talks about his whole life. Extremely successful choreographer. He worked with all kinds of people. I think Mary J. Blige, Michael, Prince, J-Lo, Britney Spears, Escape, NSYNC. He worked with a lot. And he's accomplished. So he was originally Britney Spears and NSYNC's choreographer until he decided to... He wanted to expand his horizons and got into acting and became even bigger with that. He was on the show that was based in a popular movie, Soul Food, for Showtime back in the 2000s. And he became even bigger after that. So he does do, I think he does, at times he does do some, you know, teaching of choreography and stuff like that. But mostly he's an actor and director and filmmaker. So he, when Wade Robson came forward with his ridiculous Leaving Neverland movie, Darian Henson had to say something. Now, we all know what he said. He pretty much blasted this fool because he's out here saying these crazy things. But I want to read to you what this man did for Wade Robson that made me think, I'm going to read to you what he said. My two cents on #WadeRobson, what I'm saying is truth. At Oprah, you wanted to get the truth in the #MJ. Michael Jackson, I understand as a journalist and a reporter the responsibility to get the both sides. So I'm not upset at Oprah at what I am incredibly disappointed with is the fact that this guy, Wade, after being told he could not choreograph the Vegas show by the Jackson estate, decided to go and create and produce and create this garbage. And now the world is watching. #Facts. As a world-renowned choreographer myself, I was privy to tours, dancers, convos, and much more. This guy did heavy drugs. I took Wade on the Britney tour. He was acting up with her. I put him in the You Drive Me Crazy video. This is well-produced lie. This well-produced lie has stirred up questions that should have no space in. Now, that's the far as we can go with that. But I wanted to bring this up because he stated that this individual did heavy drugs and he took him on the Britney tour. He was acting up with her. I put him in the You Drive Me Crazy video. So it tells you that this man was really trying to look out for this Wade Robson character. And all Wade Robson did was pretty much destroyed his own career. And why would this guy go out of his way to put you in a video only for you to act a fool? You're doing drugs, you're doing all this stuff. This tells me that Wade is his own worst enemy. Okay? And nothing Michael could do for him is going to save him. There's more. Someone said, Wade is a douchebag and the one to talk. He was my dance instructor when I was touring with Ashley Simpson. He was rude to women, not reliable, and often missed classes. Made homophobic comments to kids about their kids, about other kids, I'm sorry. He was teaching. He was literally awful. And also, He testified under oath that nothing happened with him and Michael Jackson. Why isn't he facing perjury charges? If that actually happened to him and he allowed to continue with other children, he should be liable for those damages. I will say I don't believe for one second Michael Jackson was a child molester. Then someone said, I knew Wade's older sister Chantel in junior high. She used to tell us that Wade would brag about having sex with girls at a really early age. I will watch the documentary, but I have my reservations about Wade's character. I know Wade from the dance industry, and he's a known liar, and it's funny how he would try to cash in this way. when his reputation with young girls at the dance conventions isn't the greatest and is known as Uncle Pervy. Believe what you want, though. And I just mentioned that somebody is having trouble trying to get charges fought against this creep. My roommate is a dancer, and she knows so many people who have worked with Wade Robson and known him personally, and they all hate the guy. His reputation in the dance world is terrible. They backed up the Uncle Pervy stories too, and aren't surprised he's getting exposed. Again, they all hate the guy. His reputation in the dance world is terrible. Okay. Oh, for F's sake, Wade, you're a lying piece of crap. You never were honest. Seriously, Marnie, how many auditions did he lie about when we were kids? Like every week. Let's do it again. Oh, F's sakes, Wade. Oh, for F's sakes, Wade. You're lying, you lying piece of crap. You were never honest. Seriously, Marnie, how many auditions did he lie about when we were kids? Like every week. I went to numerous auditions with Wade Robson as a kid. He constantly lied back then about projects he booked. Kids doing this for money. I'll go before a jury on that. I remember being on tour bus with Kool, and Wade and his mom were constantly on the phone calling Michael, complaining about this and that. He certainly wasn't afraid of him then. We all know it's bullshit. So I say this to say, people gonna smell right through you. If you're credible, this is not gonna happen to you. But if you're not credible, oh, this is gonna happen to you. Okay? He's a liar. That's how he got into Michael's life, by lying. If you remember or don't know, his mother had to lie about his age to get into that. They had a contest in Australia run by Target. Yes, the same clothing company, Target. And you were supposed to be 5 years old to be in the contest. But he was 4. But his mother lied and put him in there and said he was 5. He won. Then they found out he was not really 5 years old. He was 4 years old. He won that contest and he met Michael. That's how he met Michael. The second place winner was a gentleman by the name of Peter Andre, who happens to play, he does something in the UK for Michael. I think Thrill Alive at the UK for Michael. Peter Andre later on became a star in his own right. But yeah, he would have won first place if Wade Robson didn't lie. Or his mother in line. So, you know, the line is part of his upbringing, okay? So, that right there tells you something. You know, that's what they do, man. They lie. They don't care. They gonna keep lying. You know why? Because that's all they got. Okay? Okay, I'm just gonna get into something I wanna read. Then it was some information I found that was like, this was all in his head, meaning Wade. Britney's team said he was only hired to choreograph the promotional tour for her album Circus, which ended in Japan on December 2008. Jamie King replaced Wade to direct and choreograph her Circus tour in 2009, the same guy the estate hired for MJ1. So, I was gonna add it. I didn't add it. Okay. We'll add it later. Okay. So that's what happened. So you wondering, okay, well, why would a person like Wade play himself like this? And then you look at, you know, he would do that because he don't care. But he was accomplished as a kid. Now I don't know how. If some of these things are because he got the job because of his talent, or his mother forced people to put him in things, those are things that you need to come up on your own. Just like we read about, he's a, you know, people saying he was lying, all that, and he was lying about getting these roles when he never did. So this part of his Wikipedia page we need to read that shows that how he was established, he did his thing. So what happened? You know, it gives you an idea of maybe it wasn't enough. He wanted to have a legacy like Michael's, a career like Michael's. At age 11, Robson had an agent, along with friend Dwayne Turney, he formed the hip-hop duo Quill, and the end of the year released an album on Jackson's Entertainment label through Epic/SME Records. The following year, he was teaching dance classes in Hollywood. He formed a troupe of dancing children which performed internationally. That's what I'm saying. He formed a troupe of dancing children which would perform internationally. So he went on tour internationally. He received his first choreography job for the R&B group Immature at 14. The job led to other artists such as Britney Spears. Clients were sometimes reluctant to take direction from Robeson as self-described skinny white kid. When Spears first interviewed Robeson to choreograph her tour, she exclaimed, "He's such a freaking baby." She had expected him to be in his 30s or 40s. During the late 1990s, while still a teenager, Robeson choreographed Spears' Pepsi commercial, including one which aired on the 2001 Super Bowl. He choreographed the performance by NSYNC and Spears at the 1999 Video Music Awards and co-directed Spears' 1999/2000 World Tour as well as NSYNC's 2000's No Strings Attached Tour. In 2001, he choreographed Spears' I'm a Slave for You video and was the choreographer and director of NSYNC's 2001 Pop Odyssey Tour. In NSYNC's music video Pop, Robeson had to fill in for NSYNC member Joey Fatone during several of the dance sequences because of an injury that Fatone sustained at an NSYNC concert the night before. Yeah, I actually remember that. I actually remember him being interviewed talking about that. So that is true. But all this is accomplished. Why is this not enough? Okay, what happened? What made you go from this to a disgrace choreographer? Because you don't know your fucking place. And then a court document I saw of his mother, Lynette, or Joy. There are good people in this one named Joy, so I'm going to call her Lynette. That's her name. Proves that Mike was barely around him. More evidence that Wade Robeson is not only a pathological liar, but a stupid one. Okay? Question. And during that time of frame, you didn't hear from Michael Jackson? No, I did not. Answer. Question. He didn't respond to your letters, which he didn't receive, but you didn't otherwise hear from Michael Jackson at all, either during those 2+ years, correct? No. And you didn't hear from anyone working for him during that time. They had no contact for us. I had no contact from him either. You know, he said to us at the time, "You should come to the United States. Call me." Sure, look him up in the white pages. All right, so this whole point shows that he wasn't reaching out to these people. And you just say you should come to the United States. Okay, call me. Okay. And I didn't hear from them. Well, that tells me he doesn't want to see. Okay. Now, this part is not on the show notes. But I forgot to add this on the show notes. I'm sorry, y'all. I really got to talk about it. This is in regards to that liar, James Sachuk. In the documentary, he wanted to show that Michael inserted himself into his life. That's not true. Michael Jackson did not insert himself into your life, James Sachuk. Your family did by asking him over for dinner. And from there, your family groomed Michael into believing that he could trust your family and let you all into part of his world. Your parents led him to believe that they weren't pursuing him because of his fame and fortune, but simply because they wanted a friendship and wanted to get to know him. You were the one that created a wedge between yourself and your parents by constantly wanting to be around MJ. And that's important to put in mind, get it through people's head. And I will add this on the show notes because it shows you the lengths these failures would go. The lengths these failures would go to keep lying on Michael. And it's sad, you know what I mean? And that's what they do. You know, they do that because they know that they don't want to take any responsibility they don't want to take any responsibility in giving Michael a hard time. They wanted to make it seem like this guy was pursuing them, a busy man, he got better things to do, that's running businesses left and right, looking out for his family. He has time to talk to two people that have their own families. You see how these parents persuade this guy around their kids. This is what Stephanie Mills was saying when she was hanging out with Michael. She saw them bringing kids, leaving kids at the front of his house so they could play with him, whether they're boys or girls, leaving them right there. Who asked you to do that? So they know what they're doing. Okay? And when Michael said, I don't want to hang out with you no more, now he's a pedophile. And when we watch, what I read to you here is who these people really are. Liars. They're nobodies that, you know, they could move on with their lives and do it. But they want something out of this. And it's money. You know, they're going to say, well, that's not a reason to do that. Yeah, no, everybody wants money. Whether their debts are paid or not, they still want money. Because some people don't want to work for the rest of their lives. Well, they're not going to get the money. So bring on the trial. I'm not worried about that. And we also found out, you know, the media made sure to give us an update on Michael's killing. He's out there working, and he's opening his own clinic, but it's not in America. It's overseas. And I think the media did this out of glee to say, you know what, you guys can go honor this guy, but we got to remind people that people that did the job for us, that's destroying his legacy, they have to get their trial out there and they have to move on with their lives. Kyron Murray couldn't find a job, so now that he has a job, he's happy. No, Kyron Murray couldn't get a job because he's a killer. He killed people. He killed this guy. And those people who want to still get help from Kyron Murray, you're on your own. Because when Kyron Murray do wrong by you, don't complain. We told you to stay away from these doctors and go get a real doctor that doesn't have a background killing people. So you're on your own. Okay? You're on your own, and you got to deal with that. So that is it for today, or for this episode, I should say. Hope you guys enjoyed this episode. And the next one's coming up soon. So have a good day, good weekend, and keep cool and safe. Peace.